So, I want you to imagine just for a second that the year is 1959.
Okay, 1959.
Yeah. And you are a biologist, a very serious scientist in a crisp white lab coat, and you are staring intently at a frog.
Just a standard everyday frog.
Right, exactly. Now, as a scientist in 1959, you operate under this very specific, almost universally accepted assumption about how this frog interacts with the physical world.
Which is what exactly?
Well, you assume that the frog's eye is essentially just a biological camera.
Oh, right, the camera metaphor.
Yeah, it opens its little amphibian shutter, it takes in the light bouncing around the room, and it just passively sends a live, perfectly objective video feed of reality straight back into the frog's brain.
Yeah, the expectation back then was it was absolute fidelity.
Fidelity meaning it just shows what's there.
Exactly. The prevailing thought was that the retina encodes the light in a direct one-to-one mapping. Like the optic nerve acts as this transmission cable, and the brain just sits in the dark skull like a viewer in a movie theater.
Just watching the movie of reality.
Right? Constructing an image from that raw, unfiltered data. It's a very mechanical, very linear assumption about perception.
It assumes the world is just out there.
Yeah, the assumption that the world is simply out there and the eye just reports what is out there to the brain.
Right. It's objective. It's this clean translation of reality. But then this groundbreaking experiment
This
happens.
is the Maturana stuff, right?
Yes. A young Chilean biologist named Humberto Maturana, along with his colleagues, I think it was Letvin, McCulloch, and Pitts, they decide they aren't going to just blindly accept this camera
They
assumption.
actually want to test the hardware.
Exactly. They decide to wire up the frog's optic nerve and they physically measure exactly what the eye is telling the brain.
And what they find is wild.
It completely shatters the camera metaphor. It turns out the eye isn't sending a video feed of reality at all. It is doing something entirely different.
Right.
The eye is actively constituting a world.
It was an absolute paradigm shift, honestly. Because if the eye isn't just passively recording
Which
reality,
it isn't.
right, if it's acting as a highly selective filter that literally builds the organism's reality from scratch, then, well, everything we thought we knew about perception has to change.
Everything.
Yeah, about the brain, and ultimately, about what it actually means to be alive. It
Yeah.
all has to be completely re-examined.
And that re-examination is exactly what we are going to do today on this deep dive.
I'm ready.
So we're looking at the work of C.F. Deitz today, who took this rather bizarre frog experiment along with, decades of subsequent biological research, and he synthesized it all in an academic paper.
Titled The Grammar of Life Itself.
Yeah, The Grammar of Life Itself, how Humberto Maturana's autopoiesis became the biological foundation of the closure framework.
It's a mouthful.
It is a massive title, but don't worry, we aren't just going to sit here and read an academic paper at you.
That would be pretty dry.
Definitely. The mission for today is to explore how Maturana essentially dissolved the boundary between biology and philosophy.
He proved, biologically, that to be alive is to know.
Yes. And then we're going to look at how Deitz's modern closure framework provides the ultimate philosophical translation of these biological discoveries.
Which is so necessary because we are talking about the basic grammar of how you, as a living being, operate in the universe.
We're talking about what you are at a cellular level.
Exactly. And how that cellular reality scales up to dictate how you think, how you perceive, and even like how you interact with other human beings.
So, if you've ever found yourself wondering where your mind actually ends and the physical world begins,
Or why you sometimes feel just entirely out of sync with your environment.
yeah, this deep dive is going to fundamentally change how you view your own existence.
Let's get into it.
Okay, let's go back to that frog in 1959. The paper they published was famously titled, What the Frog's Eye Tells the Frog's Brain.
Classic paper.
So we established that the scientific community expected a faithful, pixel-by-pixel representation of objective reality. What did the data actually show?
Well, the researchers discovered that the frog's retina did not transmit a general, objective representation of the visual field at all.
Nothing like a camera.
Not even close. It didn't send a picture of a pond or a lily pad or a rock. When they recorded the electrical impulses traveling along the optic nerve, they found that the retina only responded selectively to very specific patterns.
What kind of patterns?
Things like moving edges, small dark objects darting against lighter backgrounds, sudden changes in illumination.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it ignored absolutely everything else.
Wait, so if a fly was sitting perfectly still on a rock, As far as the frog's eye was concerned, it didn't exist.
Precisely. The frog's eye wouldn't report the stationary flight of the brain at all. It just edited it out of reality completely.
That is wild.
What the frog's eye told the frog's brain was not a description of the world. It was a set of highly specific responses relevant to the frog's survival.
So it's more like an alarm system than a camera.
Yeah. The retina was essentially acting as a calculator that only outputted very specific semantic warnings. Like, food is here, or danger is near.
Or the light has suddenly dropped, so a heron might be swooping down.
Exactly. The visual system wasn't reporting reality. It was constituting a world of significance.
Okay, let's unpack this with a modern analogy, because the traditional view of the eye was like a live streaming webcam on a street corner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Passively taking in every single photon of light and sending it to a server.
Right, just a dumb pipe of data.
Yeah. But what Mathurana and his colleagues discovered is that the frog's vision is much more like a highly filtered social media algorithm.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Think about it. When you open up a social media app, it doesn't show you the entire internet.
That would be impossible.
And useless.
Exactly. It only shows you what its internal logic determines is highly relevant to your specific engagement. It constitutes what is significant and completely blinds you to the rest.
That's a really helpful way to visualize it. But, you know, we actually have to push it even further. Further than the algorithm.
Yeah, because a social media algorithm is still filtering a pre-existing stream of content. Mathurana's point was more radical.
Yeah.
What's fascinating here is that the frog isn't just filtering objective reality.
What is it doing, then?
The physical structure of its eye is what actually allows a moving dark spot to exist as a concept for the frog in the first place.
Oh, I see.
The frog isn't failing to see objective reality. We shouldn't look at this and say, oh, the poor dumb amphibian has a broken camera.
Right, it's not a bug, it's a feature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The frog is actively organizing its relationship to its environment. Its perception is an active engagement, not a passive reception.
So if perception isn't a camera taking pictures of reality, we are forced to ask a massive question here.
Which is?
If we aren't just empty hard drives downloading data from the universe, What is the fundamental nature of the organism doing the perceiving?
What are we if not passive observers?
Right.
Well, that was the exact wall Mathurana hit. He realized he couldn't explain perception without first explaining the perceiver.
Makes sense. You need to know what the machine is before you know how it works.
Yeah, and he needed a biological definition of life itself that didn't rely on just listing traits like it moves or it reproduces.
Because plenty of non-living things move.
Exactly. And that search led him to his most revolutionary concept, autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis.
Yeah, he coined this term around 1970, drawing from the Greek roots auto, meaning self, and poiesis, meaning creation or production.
Like poetry, right, same root.
Exactly the same root. So autopoiesis translates literally to self-production.
Self-production, I mean, it sounds almost poetic, maybe a bit mystical, but he meant it in a very rigorous, mechanical way, right?
Extremely rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
Mathurana defined an autopoietic system as a network of processes that produces the very components that constitute it.
Okay, give me an example.
The ultimate paradigm case of this is a single living cell.
Just a basic cell.
Right. Think about the metabolic network inside a cell. It produces proteins, lipids, and all the other molecules that make up the cell's physical structure, including its boundary, the cell membrane.
Okay, so it builds its own walls.
Yeah, and then that very structure, those walls, those proteins, they constitute and maintain the metabolic network that produces them.
It's a loop.
It is a system that literally builds itself continuously out of its own process.
Okay, wait. Let me pause you there, because when I first read this definition of autopoiesis, my immediate thought was, wait a minute, how is this unique to life?
I know where you're going with this.
Right, because isn't a machine self-maintaining? Like, if I buy a high-end generator and I keep putting gas in it, it keeps its own motor running. It maintains its internal temperature.
The classic machine counterargument.
Well, let's take it a step further. What about a modern AI algorithm that is designed to rewrite its own code based on new data? It's generating its own internal state. How is a cell any different from a highly complex, self-updating machine?
That is the exact pushback that always comes up, and it's a crucial distinction we have to make. Let's look at your generator first.
Okay, the generator.
A generator does maintain its organization, yes, but it does so by processing inputs that are provided entirely from the outside, and its purpose is defined from the outside.
Right, I have to pour the gas in.
You have to pour the gas in. The generator didn't build the gas. nor did it build the steel casing that holds the gas, nor did it decide that generating electricity was its overarching goal in life.
Its boundary and its purpose were engineered by a human.
Precisely.
Okay, but what about the AI? The AI is rewriting its own code. It's updating itself. It feels a lot more alive than a generator.
The AI is closer, I'll give you that, but it still falls short of true autopoiesis.
How so?
The AI might rewrite its software, but does not manufacture the silicon chips it runs on. It doesn't mine the copper for its wiring. It doesn't build the server rack.
Right, the hardware is external.
Exactly. A living system, an autopoietic system, produces its own physical boundary and its own internal components. The processes are entirely internal to the system, and they refer only to themselves.
So the cell's only goal is to continue being a cell.
Yes. This is what Majorana called being organizationally closed.
Organizationally closed, meaning the system is entirely self-referential in how it defines its own existence.
Right. It doesn't exist for the sake of the environment. It exists for the sake of itself.
Okay, that makes sense.
And this leads to a vital distinction Majorana made, one that C.F. Dietz leans heavily on in his paper. It's the difference between a system's organization and its structure.
Organization versus structure. Okay, let's break that down.
The organization is the autopoietic closure itself. It's the abstract network of rules and relationships that makes a cell, and not just a random puddle of chemical soup.
The blueprint, kind of.
Right. The structure, on the other hand, is the specific, ever-changing physical molecules that happen to be embodying that organization at any given microsecond.
Okay, I want to make sure I really understand this organization versus structure split, because Dietz makes this the absolute cornerstone of his closure framework.
He really does.
Dietz basically takes this biological reality of the cell and elevates it into a universal philosophical principle. He calls autopoiesis a closure regime.
Yeah, Dietz recognized that Majorana had discovered something that applied far beyond just cellular biology.
So what exactly is a closure regime? In his words,
a closure regime, in Dietz's framework, is any system that stabilizes content, establishes identity criteria, and draws a firm boundary between what is inside and what is outside.
By defining itself.
Exactly. By producing its own boundary conditions, the system declares what is me and what is not me. The cell's autopoietic network draws that distinction perfectly. It maintains the identity criteria that make this particular cell, this specific cell, regardless of the physical matter flowing through it.
You know, it's really the biological equivalent of the Ship of Theseus paradox.
Oh, that's a perfect comparison.
You know the one, right? If you replace every single plank of wood on a ship over the years, is it still the same ship?
And biology says yes, absolutely.
Because the organization remains, even if the structure changes. Think about your own body, the listener's body, your physical structure, your actual bodily cells, the carbon, the water, the molecules, they're replacing themselves constantly.
Constant.
You shed skin, you metabolize food, your bones regenerate. Over the course of a few years, almost every atom in your body has been swapped out for a new one from the environment.
Yep.
Your physical structure is completely different today than it was a decade ago, and yet you remain you. Your organization, your closure regime persists.
It's the ultimate paradox of biology, really.
Right.
You only maintain your identity through constant, relentless structural flux.
Life has to continuously change just to stay the same.
Yes. Life has to continuously change its physical structure just to stay exactly the same organizationally. If the flux stops, if you stop metabolizing, if you stop replacing your structure with new molecules, yeah, your organization collapses.
You die.
You die. Plain and simple.
Wow. Okay, so we have this concept of a living system as a closure regime. It is organizationally closed. It draws a strict boundary. It has its own internal rules. It produces itself. And its only purpose is to maintain its own identity.
That's the foundation, yes.
But obviously, living things don't exist in a vacuum. I mean, a cell is surrounded by fluid. A frog is surrounded by a pond. You and I are sitting in a room breathing air.
Right. There's an environment.
And this is the part that I found slightly tricky in the reading. Because if a system is entirely closed off and self-referential, how on earth does it interact with the outside world without dissolving its boundary and losing its identity?
This is the exact problem Majorana had to solve.
Yeah.
If we are closed systems, how do we know anything about the world?
Right.
And this brings us to his concept of structural coupling.
Structural coupling.
Yeah. An autopoietic system is organizationally closed, as we establish, but it is structurally open.
Oh, okay. Closed organizationally, open structurally.
Exactly. It has to be structurally open to take in nutrients and expel waste. It meets the world at its boundary through this process of structural coupling.
So the environment and the organism are meeting at that boundary line, physically interacting.
Yes, they are interacting, but we have to completely rethink cause and effect here. In structural coupling, the environment does not instruct the living system on what to do.
It doesn't.
No, it only perturbs it.
Okay, instruction versus perturbation. Let's unpack that.
So the traditional view, the camera view we talked about earlier, assumes the environment instructs the organism. It assumes the light goes into the frog's eye and says, I'm a fly, see me as a fly.
Here is the data. Process it.
That's instruction. Majorana says no. The environment only triggers a perturbation. The specific structural change that occurs in the organism is determined entirely by the organism's own organization, not by the environment.
I was actually trying to find a good analogy for this, and the paper touched on some mechanical examples. Think about a vending machine.
Oh, I like this one.
If I walk up to a vending machine and I want a soda, I push the button that says A4. Me pushing that button is a perturbation.
Right.
Now, I didn't reach into the machine, grab the soda, and force it down the chute. I didn't put the soda in the machine. I just triggered it.
Yes.
The machine's own internal wiring, its own organization, determined that the appropriate response to the perturbation of the A4 button being pushed was to release a cola. I perturbed it. Its organization determined the response.
That's a solid mechanical way to understand the trigger mechanism. The button push doesn't contain a soda. It doesn't even contain the idea of a soda. It's just a physical trigger.
Right.
The machine's internal state translates that trigger into an action. Now, map that onto biology.
Look at biology.
Take a bacterium swimming in a petri dish. If it encounters a gradient of glucose, the glucose isn't giving the bacterium a set of instructions that says, hey, I am food, you should swim toward me.
The glucose doesn't care.
The glucose simply provides a perturbation at the bacterium's boundary, a chemical interaction. It is the bacterium's own internal autopoietic organization that determines that swimming toward the glucose is the appropriate structural response to maintain its own life. The world triggers. The organism decides based on its own closure.
And here is where Deitz's paper really elevates this into a broader philosophy. Because a living system, a closure regime, is finite.
Forever and ever.
It has a physical boundary. It is limited by its own internal organization. And because it's finite, it absolutely cannot model or understand everything that exists outside of it in the infinite universe.
Impossible.
When the infinite complexity of the universe bumps up against the finite boundary of a living system, it generates this unmodelable stuff. And Deitz has a specific term for that. He calls it remainder.
The remainder. It is such a powerful, elegant concept. It is the formal name for the mismatch between what a closure regime can model and what the world actually presents.
Give me an example of remainder.
Let's go back to our bacterium in the petri dish. The bacterium's organization allows it to model a glucose gradient as a relevant perturbation. It knows how to interact with glucose to maintain its autopoiesis.
Right. Sugar is good.
But what if you bombard that petri dish with ultraviolet radiation?
Ooh.
The bacterium doesn't have the internal organization to model UV radiation as a perturbation it can effectively respond to. It can't sense it. It can't move away from it.
So it's just blind to it.
The UV radiation is remainder. It's real. It's impacting the boundary. It's literally destroying the organism's structure. But the system cannot process it within its current identity criteria.
This completely reframes how we think about the environment. Because if structural coupling is just an organism responding to perturbations based on its own internal rules and ignoring the remainder it can't process, then the environment isn't this objective pre-given reality that we are all sharing equally.
No, not at all.
The environment is what Deitz and Majorana call a niche.
Exactly. A niche is the specific domain of interactions that a system's organization permits. There is no such thing as a view from nowhere. Every living system has a world. But that world is constituted strictly by what its organization makes relevant.
Right. So you could have two completely different organisms, say, a microscopic tardigrade and our glucose-loving bacterium occupying the exact same physical droplet of water.
Sure.
But they inhabit entirely different niches. To the bacterium, the water droplet is a world of chemical gradients. To the tardigrade, it's a world of physical obstacles and different microorganisms to consume.
Yep.
They are literally experiencing different worlds, even though they are in the exact same physical space, because their organizational closures generate completely different relevant perturbations.
And completely different remainders.
Exactly.
And Dietz makes the argument that this remainder, this unmodelable stuff crashing against the boundary, is actually the hidden engine of evolution itself.
The engine of evolution? How so?
Think about it as structural pressure. If an organism is perfectly suited to its environment, like if it can successfully model every perturbation it encounters and maintain its autopoiesis without fail, there's no remainder.
No friction.
There's no friction, and therefore nothing changes. The organism just keeps looping its self-production perfectly. But the world is not static.
Great. The world changes.
The world is always shifting, always throwing things at the boundary that the organism's current organization can't quite handle. That mismatch, that friction of the remainder, is what forces the organism to either adapt its physical structure or die.
So the remainder is the driver of biological time. It forces the system to upgrade its grammar, so to speak.
Yes. What's fascinating here is that a finite closure regime will always encounter aspects of the world that exceed its modeling capacity. The remainder is proof that the organism's grammar is finite, and it represents the horizon of its existence.
That's a beautiful way to say it.
Evolution isn't just about random mutation. It's about systems structurally coupling with an environment that constantly produces remainder, forcing continuous structural adaptation just to maintain organizational closure.
Okay. I really want to pull these threads together, because if a simple bacterium is successfully managing these complex perturbations, if it is successfully navigating its highly specific niche based on its own internal organization, recognizing glucose, ignoring the rest, and surviving the friction of the remainder, it sounds an awful lot like it is exhibiting a behavior that we usually, somewhat arrogantly, reserve only for humans with giant brains.
It does.
It sounds like the bacterium is actually thinking.
And this brings us to what is arguably Majkarana's most radical, most fiercely debated claim.
The big one.
He stated, unequivocally, that cognition is not a special capacity of organisms with nervous systems.
Wow.
Cognition is not thinking in the way humans define conscious linguistic thought. Cognition is simply the effective maintenance of organizational identity in the face of what the world presents.
Okay, so wait.
Therefore, in Majkarana's exact words, to live is to know.
To live is to know. That is a massive, heavy statement. Under this biological definition, cognition is just the act of successfully staying alive.
Precisely. If knowing is defined as effectively distinguishing relevant perturbations from irrelevant ones and responding in a way that maintains your autopoiesis, then every single living thing cognizes.
Every single.
The bacterium navigating the glucose gradient is cognizing. Your immune system is a brilliant example of this, actually. Mm. When your immune system distinguishes a foreign virus from your own healthy tissue, it is cognizing.
And the immune system doesn't have a brain. It doesn't have eyes.
No brain, no eyes, no central nervous system. But it knows self from non-self, and it acts effectively on that knowledge. It structurally couples with the virus, recognizes the perturbation, and responds by producing antibodies.
And if it fails?
If it fails to cognize accurately, like if it gets confused and attacks your own tissue or ignores the virus completely, the autopoiesis of the larger organism fails, the organism dies.
So, knowing isn't about having a correct encyclopedic picture of the world in your head. It's not about capital T truth. It's just about fit. It's about taking effective action within your niche.
Yes. Knowing is not a representation of reality inside a brain. That is the fundamental trap we've been stuck in for centuries.
Right.
Knowing is the physical, effective operation of a living system in its medium. If your physical structure allows you to survive the perturbation, you possess knowledge of that perturbation.
But I want to linger on this because it raises a massive philosophical problem for me. If knowing is just fit, if it's just surviving the perturbations, does that mean all of Western philosophy since Descartes has been operating on a false premise?
Oh, absolutely.
Let's rewind a bit just to set the stage for the listener. René Descartes famously split the mind and the body in the 17th century. Cartesian dualism. He said there is the physical, mechanical stuff of the world, the res extensa, and then there is the ethereal thinking stuff of the mind, the res cogitans. And he argued they are fundamentally separate substances. Is Majkarana saying that entire foundational split is a total illusion?
He is saying exactly that. Majkarana dissolves the Cartesian boundary entirely. You have to understand why Descartes' split felt so intuitive and why it survived for hundreds of years.
Because it feels right.
Exactly. It feels obvious to us that our thoughts are somehow made of different stuff than our physical brains. It feels like we are pilots driving a meat suit.
The ghost in the machine.
Yeah. And that dualism relies heavily on the camera metaphor, We started with the idea that the physical body just mechanically gathers data from the objective world and passes it up to the mind to be analyzed and judged.
Right. The mind is the judge sitting in the courtroom looking at the evidence presented by the body.
Exactly. But if the frog's eye proves that perception is active constitution, not passive reflection.
Which we know it is.
Right. And if autopoiesis proves that knowing is just effective biological action, then there is no courtroom.
Wow.
There is no judge sitting separate from the evidence. The mind is just the body's effective operation. Knowledge is biological.
The knower is the known.
The organism and the environment are structurally coupled, locked in this continuous dance of perturbation and response. You cannot separate the knower from the known because the knower is actively constituting the known through its very biology. The Cartesian split vanishes.
Okay, I see how the biology forces that conclusion, but I'm going to be honest, and Dietz points this out in his paper too.
What's that?
Majorana's biological explanation still leaves a massive gaping hole when it comes to our actual human experience.
The hard problem of consciousness.
Yes, because Majorana brilliantly explains the mechanics of cognition, how a system survives, how it adapts, how it navigates a niche, but he doesn't really explain the experience of it, the felt reality.
Right, the what it is like to be you.
Because we don't just effectively manage perturbations. We feel things. We experience the vivid redness of an apple, the warmth of the sun on our skin, the existential panic of realizing we left the stove on.
Sure.
Where does that actual lived consciousness fit into a mechanical closure regime? If we are just complex immune systems managing boundaries, why does the light turn on inside the house at all?
That is the exact threshold where Majorana's biology needed Dietz's philosophy.
Oh, okay.
Majorana explained how biological content is managed, but he couldn't fully account for conscious presence itself. Dietz steps in to fill this gap in the closure framework by introducing a crucial, nuanced distinction between two types of consciousness, big C consciousness and little C consciousness.
Big C and little C. Okay, let's break those down. What is little C consciousness?
Little C consciousness is consciousness with content. It's the stuff you are actually aware of in any given moment.
Like what I'm looking at right now.
Exactly. It's the glucose gradient for the bacterium. For you, it's the moving shadow out of the corner of your eye, the sound of my voice, the memory of what you had for breakfast.
So it's the details.
Yeah, and Majorana's theory of autopoiesis perfectly explains little C. It is generated by organizational closure and structural coupling. Your biological boundaries define what content is relevant enough to enter your awareness.
Like the frog's little C consciousness is filled with erratic flying bugs, not stationary ones.
Perfect example.
Okay, so little C is the movie playing on the screen. It's the specific imagery, sounds, and thoughts. What is big C consciousness then?
Big C consciousness is the screen itself.
The screen itself.
It is the bare conscious presence, the very fact that there is a what it's like to be you in the first place. The pure felt interiority of existing, independent of any specific thought or sensory input.
Just the awareness of being aware.
Exactly. Yeah. And Dietz argues that autopoiesis doesn't miraculously create big C consciousness out of dead, inert matter. Instead, Dietz treats big C as a foundational primitive of the universe.
A primitive.
Something that is just fundamentally there.
Yeah.
Like gravity or electromagnetism.
Wait, hold on a second. So he's dipping into panpsychism. The idea that consciousness is a fundamental property of matter.
It skirts the edge of it, yes.
Interesting.
Dietz suggests that autopoiesis is the structural mechanism that organizes this ambient big C presence into specific little C content.
Okay, I think I follow.
A rock might not have a closure regime to organize big C into a coherent niche, but a cell does. The biological boundary of the cell captures that primitive presence and focuses it into a point of view.
So Majorana gave us the hardware specs, and Dietz gives us the theory for why the hardware actually feels like something.
That is a brilliant way to summarize it, yes.
That distinction really helps. And Dietz also introduces this concept of supersession to explain how that internal content, that little C consciousness, actually grows and changes over time.
Right, it does, yeah.
We talked earlier about remainder, the unmodelable stuff building up at the organism's boundary, causing friction. Dietz says that when the remainder accumulates beyond what the system can absorb, when the mismatch gets too intense, the system must undergo supersession.
Yes. Supersession is arguably the most dramatic event in the life of a closure regime.
What exactly triggers it?
It happens when the current identity criteria of the system, its current set of rules for making sense of the world, are no longer adequate to survive the perturbations it's facing. The system is overwhelmed by a remainder.
So it's a crisis.
It is a total crisis. To survive, the system is forced to update its fundamental rules. It has to alter its organizational closure to incorporate the remainder, turning the unknown into the known.
I really want to ground this in a human example because updating identity criteria sounds very, you know, sterile and robotic.
It does.
When I was trying to understand supersession, I thought about massive paradigm shifts in a human life.
Like what?
Think about someone becoming a parent for the first time. Before you have a child, your closure regime, your identity criteria, your daily routines, what you consider significant is oriented entirely around yourself.
Right. Your career, your sleep, your hobbies.
Exactly. Then a child arrives. This is a massive, undeniable perturbation. And suddenly, your old identity criteria are completely inadequate for this new reality.
Yeah, totally inadequate.
The exhaustion, the profound responsibility, the vulnerability of this new life, it all acts as remainder that your old single-person organization cannot process.
You literally don't have the grammar for it yet.
Right. Yeah. You experience immense friction. You might even feel like you are breaking down. But then supersession occurs. You don't just learn a new skill. Your actual identity shifts. Your boundaries expand. You reorganize your entire closure regime so that the survival and well-being of the child is now a fundamental part of your identity criteria. You've structurally updated to turn that remainder into a core part of your known world.
That is a beautiful, highly accurate translation of the concept. The arrival of the child shatters the old closure regime. The friction is the accumulation of remainder. And the new parent, the new organizational state, is the result of supersession.
And what happens if you refuse?
If you refuse to undergo supersession, like if you try to force the reality of a child into the identity criteria of a carefree bachelor, the system breaks down. It fails.
It crashes.
In biological terms, it's death. In psychological terms, it's deep dysfunction. Supersession is the painful, necessary expansion of the self to encompass more of the world's complexity.
So, to summarize where we are, living is knowing. Knowing is this constant, desperate management of our biological boundaries against the infinite remainder of the universe, occasionally forcing us into these painful periods of supersession where we literally have to upgrade our identity just to survive.
That's the grammar of life itself.
That is intense, but it gets even more complicated.
It always does.
Because up until now, we've mostly been talking about a bacterium dealing with sugar, or a frog dealing with flies, or an individual dealing with their environment.
Solitary systems.
Right. But what happens when the most significant, complex features in our environment aren't chemicals or light, but other human beings?
This is the natural and perhaps most profound progression of Maturana's work. In his later years, he realized he had to move from the cellular level to the social level.
He had to scale it up.
Exactly. Because if we are all just finite closure regimes, organizationally closed systems bumping into each other in the dark, how do we ever form societies? How do we communicate? How do we build cultures?
It seems impossible if we're entirely closed off.
Right. Maturana argued that ethics, language, and sociality are not abstract moral concepts imposed from the outside by religion or philosophy.
What are they then?
They are strict biological requirements for our survival. And he called this foundational biological mechanism the biology of love.
The biology of love. I have to admit, when I first read that heading in the paper, it sounded a bit like a 1970s folk album.
I get that a lot.
But again, he is being deeply analytical here. He's not talking about romance. How does a rigorous biologist define love?
Maturana defines love biologically as the acceptance of the other, as a legitimate other in the domain of coexistence.
Okay, let's translate that back into the closure framework we've built.
Sure. When you encounter another human being, you are encountering another autopoietic system, another incredibly complex closure regime.
Right.
If you treat them merely as an object to be manipulated, if you view them the same way you view a vending machine or a tool, you are engaging in competitive structural coupling. You are trying to force their immense complexity, the remainder, to fit neatly into your niche.
You're trying to make them conform to your identity criteria, which, based on my own experience, usually results in a lot of friction, defensiveness, and arguing.
Exactly. Because they have their own organizational closure that resists being subsumed by yours. But love is the specific biological condition that allows for a completely different kind of structural coupling.
A better kind.
It is a coupling that creates a shared cognitive world, rather than a battle for dominance. When you accept the other as a legitimate other, you are allowing their organization to coexist with yours without trying to destroy it, manipulate it, or reduce it to your own terms.
I was trying to find the right metaphor for this. Initially, I thought of it as a sort of biological hack, like intentionally lowering your shields.
That's not bad.
But I think a better way to look at it is like grafting a branch onto a tree or two complex ecosystems slowly merging. Normally, your biological boundary is entirely defensive, right? You protect your autopoietic identity against the remainder of the world.
Right, that's the default state.
But when you engage in the biology of love with someone, you are taking this infinitely complex, unmodelable person whose remainder is vast, and instead of defensively bouncing off them, you invite their remainder in.
Yes.
You allow their unmodelable complexity to actually trigger perturbations that alter your own structure. You let their existence change your identity criteria.
That ecosystem metaphor is perfect, and it aligns beautifully with Deeds' synthesis. Love is the willingness to let the other's remainder actually reach you.
Wow.
To allow what you cannot fully model or control to trigger genuine structural change in yourself, genuine supersession, rather than defensive rejection. It is arguably the most demanding, vulnerable form of structural coupling a biological system can endure, because you are risking your current organizational closure to build a larger shared one.
And Dietz takes this one step further by introducing his concept of M. We've talked extensively about the environment, the niche, the remainder, but what is the ultimate source of all this perturbation?
The ground floor of reality.
Right. What is the actual objective reality that all of us finite closure regimes are bumping around in? Dietz calls it M.
Yes. Maturana always acknowledged there was a physical medium out there, but he couldn't describe it positively because his whole theory dictates that we can only ever know our own specific niches.
We only know what our boundaries allow us to know.
Exactly. Dietz explicitly names this underlying medium M. It is the inexhaustible ground of reality. It has real structure. It generates genuine perturbations, but it is infinitely, unfathomably complex.
So we can never truly see it.
It can never, ever be fully captured or modeled by any finite organism, no matter how advanced. M is the ultimate source of all remainder.
So M is basically the universe in its rawest, most unfiltered, infinite state. It's the objective reality that the frog's eye had to filter out just to survive.
Correct. And here's where the biology of love connects to cosmology.
How so?
When humans engage in this deep social coupling, when they open their closure regimes to the infinite complexity of another human being, they are engaging in the most direct biological contact with M that is possible for our species.
Because the other person is also a manifestation of M.
Exactly. By accepting the inexhaustible remainder of another person, rather than trying to force them into a neat little box, you are making contact with the inexhaustible ground of reality itself. Love is the finite closure reaching toward the infinite M.
I really want you, the listener, to pause and reflect on this in the context of your own daily life. Think about the last time you had a bitter, entrenched argument with a partner, a family member, or a friend.
We've all been there.
Were you really communicating, or were you just two closed-off closure regimes, defensively protecting your boundaries, bouncing off each other's unmodelable remainder? You were likely experiencing their perspective as a literal threat to your internal organization.
That's exactly what an argument is, biologically speaking.
Now think about what it would biologically mean to stop defending. What if you accepted their remainder as legitimate and allowed yourself to be structurally changed by it? That isn't just a metaphor for personal growth, or a nice thing a therapist might say. According to Maturana and Dietz, that is the literal biological mechanics of human connection.
It's a staggering realization when you let it sink in. We became human. We developed culture, language, and shared meaning through an evolutionary history where structural coupling was characterized by this mutual acceptance.
The foundation of everything we are.
The cognitive niche of humanness, our shared world, was built entirely on this biological foundation of love. Without it, we are just isolated monads, defensively bouncing off one another.
As we start to pull back and look at the grand scope of Dietz's paper, he does this incredible job of tracing the scientific lineage that got us to this realization.
It's quite a lineage.
Because Maturana didn't exist in a vacuum, and Dietz sees this grand unified theory emerging across multiple distinct disciplines over the last century. Can we walk through that lineage? Because it's fascinating how many different fields are converging on this exact same truth.
It is a beautiful trajectory, and Dietz maps it out meticulously. He argues that all these brilliant minds across different decades and disciplines were essentially describing the exact same underlying reality, just using different vocabularies.
So where does it start?
It starts, as we've discussed, with Maturana and the biological realm. proving that living cells are self-producing organizational closures, autopoiesis.
Right.
Then, Dietz scales the lineage up to Dennis Noble in the field of systems biology. Noble introduced the concept of biological relativity.
Right, let's unpack Noble for a second, because Maturana was focused mostly on the single cell. But Noble asked, what happens when you have a billion cells working together?
Exactly. Noble showed how these nested levels of closure regimes, cells making up organs, organs making up bodies, exert what he calls downward causation on each other.
Downward causation, meaning what?
Meaning it's not just bottom-up chemistry. The higher level closure regime, say your beating heart, actually sets the boundary conditions for the lower level cells that make it up. The organization of the whole dictates the behavior of the parts, just as much as the parts dictate the whole.
That makes perfect sense. And from systems biology, Dietz moves the lineage into mathematics and neuroscience, specifically focusing on Carl Friston. Friston is a massive name in modern neuroscience.
Friston is essential here. Friston developed the free energy principle and relies heavily on the concept of Markov blankets.
Markov blankets? That sounds cozy but complicated.
It's a statistical boundary. It's a mathematical way of describing how a system separates its internal states from external states in order to minimize surprise or unpredictability.
Which sounds exactly like a closure regime managing remainder.
It is the exact same concept translated into pure mathematics. Friston's math shows how a system actively infers the state of the outside world by sampling its boundary, the Markov blanket, and updating its internal models to stay alive.
So it's autopoiesis and structural coupling described through statistical mechanics.
Yes. Then, the lineage moves from math to pure philosophy with Hilary Lawson. Lawson articulated a theory called closure, arguing that all human knowledge, language, and perception is constituted entirely through acts of closure over an open, chaotic, ineffable world.
Lawson essentially said that the universe is just a wash of interconnected stuff, and the only way we can think or speak is by drawing arbitrary boundaries around things and saying, this is a cup or this is a dog. We have to close the openness to make sense of it.
Precisely. And finally, Dietz brings all of these threads together into his own CCC framework. He synthesizes Maturana's biology, Noble's systems, Friston's math, and Lawson's philosophy.
He ties a bow on it.
They're all describing the exact same fundamental reality. Finite organized systems, generating boundaries, encountering unmalleable remainder, and opening onto an inexhaustible ground M that forever exceeds them.
It's incredible to see it all lay out like that. We started with a group of scientists poking at a frog's optic nerve in 1959, trying to understand how it saw a fly.
A very specific, very small question.
And from that single thread, we pull and pull until we have unraveled the mathematical equations of the human brain, the nature of consciousness, and the deepest philosophical questions of existence. It truly is the grammar of life itself.
And I think the greatest takeaway is that it reminds us that science and philosophy are not separate endeavors. We often treat them like they are the scientists in the lab, the philosophers in the armchair.
Right, totally siloed off.
But when you look deeply enough into the physical mechanics of a single microscopic cell, if you really pay attention to what it is doing, you inevitably find yourself staring into the fundamental nature of the cosmos. Maturana spent 60 years reading this grammar in frogs and cells, and Dietz has finally given us the comprehensive language to speak it across all disciplines.
I want to thank you, the listener, for sticking with us on this deep dive. I know this was heavy, mind-bending material. We challenged some of the most fundamental assumptions about reality today.
We really did.
But understanding this framework is so crucial to understanding what we actually are. And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We've talked extensively about how every single living cell is a closure regime, managing its own boundary, generating its own remainder against the universe.
Billions of them.
Yes, your entire body, the vessel you are sitting in right now, is a nested hierarchy of billions upon billions of these closures. You are a walking universe of boundaries.
It's a beautiful image.
All of these billions of cells are constantly generating remainder. All of them are constantly metabolizing, dying, and reconstructing their physical structure just to keep your overarching organization, the thing you call you, the same.
Just to keep the lights on.
Exactly. If that is true, then the you that you feel yourself to be, that static identity you look at in the mirror every morning, isn't a static object at all. You are not a noun. You are an ongoing, precarious, and incredibly beautiful biological argument with the universe. You are a verb.
A verb. I love that.
And if you are just a massive nested hierarchy of finite closures desperately interacting with the infinite, then tonight, when you step outside and look up at the vastness of the stars, ask yourself a question. Are you really seeing the universe out there? Or are you just feeling the infinite remainder of M bumping against the edges of your own mind?